Chapter 18. "Where's Miss Viner?" he asked, as Effie climbed upon him. "Why isn't she here to chain up this ungovernable infant? Poor Miss Viner has a headache. Effie says she went to her room as soon as lessons were over and sent word that she wouldn't be down for tea." "Ah," said Owen, abruptly setting down his cup. He stood up, lit another cigarette, and wandered away to the piano in the room beyond. From the twilight where he sat, a lonely music, borne on fantastic chords, floated to the group about the tea table. Under its influence, Madame de Chantel's meditative pauses increased in length and frequency, and Effie stretched herself on the hearth, her drowsy head against the dog. Presently her nurse appeared, and Anna rose at the same time. "Stop a minute in my sitting room on your way up," she paused to say to Darrow as she went. A few hours earlier, her request would have brought him instantly to his feet. As he had given him, on the day of his arrival, an inviting glimpse of the spacious book-lined room above stairs in which S.E. had gathered together all the tokens of her personal tastes. The retreat in which, as one might fancy, Anna Leith had hidden the restless ghost of Anna Summers, and the thought of a talk with her there had been in his mind ever since. But now he sat motionless, as if spellbound by the play of Madame de Chantel's needles and the pulsations of Owen's fitful music. "She will want to ask me about the girl," he repeated to himself, with a fresh sense of the insidious taint that embittered all his thoughts. The hand of the slender columned clock on the mantelpiece had spanned a half hour before shame at his own indecision finally drew him to his feet. From her writing table, where she sat over a pile of letters, Anna lifted her happy smile. The impulse to press his lips to it made him come close and draw her upward. She threw her head back, as if surprised at the abruptness of the gesture, then her face leaned to his with the slow droop of a flower. He felt again the sweep of the secret tides, and all his fears went down in them. She sat down in the sofa corner by the fire, and he drew an armchair close to her. His gaze roamed peacefully about the quiet room. "It's just like you, it is you," he said, as his eyes came back to her. "It's a good place to be alone in. I don't think I've ever before cared to talk with anyone here." "Let's be quiet, then. It's the best way of talking." "Yes, but we must save it up till later. There are things I want to say to you now." He leaned back in his chair. "Say them, then, and I'll listen." "Oh, no. I want you to tell me about Miss Viner." "About Miss Viner?" He summoned up a look of faint interrogation. He thought she seemed surprised at his surprise. "She's important, naturally," she explained, "that I should find out all I can about her before I leave." "Important on Effie's account?" "On Effie's account, of course. Of course. But you've every reason to be satisfied, haven't you?" "Every apparent reason. We all like her. Effie's very fond of her, and she seems to have a delightful influence on the child. But we know so little, after all, about her antecedents, I mean, and her past history. That's why I want you to try and recall everything you heard about her when you used to see her in London." "Oh, on that score I'm afraid I shan't be of much use. As I told you, she was a mere shadow in the background of the house I saw her in, and that was 4 or 5 years ago." "When she was with a Mrs. Murt?" "Yes, an appalling woman who runs a roaring dinner factory that used now and then to catch me in its wheels. I escaped from them long ago, but in my time there used to be half a dozen fagged hands to tend the machine, and Miss Viner was one of them. I'm glad she's out of it, poor girl." "Then you never really saw anything of her there?" "I never had the chance. Mrs. Murt discouraged any competition on the part of her subordinates. Especially such pretty ones, I suppose." Darrow made no comment, and she continued, "Colin and Mrs. Murt's own opinion, if she'd offered you one, probably wouldn't have been of much value. Only insofar as her disapproval would, on general principles, have been a good mark for Miss Viner. But surely," he went on after a pause, "you could have found out about her from the people through whom you for first heard of her? Anna smiled. H. We heard of her through Adelaide Painter, and in reply to his glance of interrogation she explained that the lady in question was a spinster of South Braintree, Massachusetts, who, having come to Paris some 30 years earlier to nurse a brother through an illness, had ever since protestingly and provisionally camped there in a state of contemptuous protestation oddly manifested by her never taking the slip covers off her drawing room chairs. Her long residence on Gallic soil had not mitigated her hostility toward the creed and customs of the race, but though she always referred to the Catholic Church as the Scarlet Woman, and took the darkest views of French private life, Madame de Chantel placed great reliance on her judgment and experience, and in every domestic crisis the irreducible Adelaide was immediately summoned to give her. It's all a yodder, because my mother-in-law, since her second marriage, has lived so much in the country that she's practically lost sight of all her other American friends. Besides which, you can see how completely she has identified herself with Monsieur de Chantel's nationality and adopted French habits and prejudices. Yet when anything goes wrong, she always sends for Adelaide Painter, who's more American than the Stars and Stripes, and might have left South Braintree yesterday, if she hadn't, rather, brought it over with her in her trunk. Darrow laughed. L, then, if South Braintree vouches for Miss Viner, oh, but only indirectly. When we had that odious adventure with Mademoiselle Grumeau, who'd been so highly recommended by Monsieur de Chantel's aunt, the Chanoness, Adelaide was of course sent for, and she said at once, I'm not the least bit surprised. I've always told you that what you wanted for Effie was a sweet American girl, and not one of these nasty foreigners. Unluckily she couldn't, at the moment, put her hand on a sweet American. But she presently heard of Miss Viner through the Farlows, an excellent couple who live in the Quartier Latin, and write about French life for the American papers. I was only too thankful to find anyone who was vouched for by decent people, and so far I've had no cause to regret my choice. But I know, after all, very little about Miss Viner, and there are all kinds of reasons why I want, as soon as possible, to find out more, to find out all I can. Since you've got to leave Effie, I understand your feeling in that way. But is there, in such a case, any recommendation worth half as much as your own direct experience? No, and it's been so favorable that I was ready to accept it as conclusive. Only, naturally, when I found you'd known her in London, I was in hopes you'd give me some more specific reasons for liking her as much as I do. I'm afraid I can give you nothing more specific than my general vague impression that she seems very plucky and extremely nice. You don't, at any rate, know anything specific to the contrary? To the contrary? How should I? I'm not conscious of ever having heard anyone say two words about her. I only infer that she must have pluck and character to have stuck it out so long at Mrs. Mertz. Yes, poor thing. She has pluck, certainly, and pride too, which must have made it all the harder. Anna rose to her feet. You don't know how glad I am that your impression's on the whole so good. I particularly wanted you to like her. He drew her to him with a smile. In that condition I'm prepared to love even Adelaide Painter. I almost hope you won't have the chance to, poor Adelaide. Her appearance here always coincides with a catastrophe. Oh, then I must manage to meet her elsewhere. He held Anna closer, saying to himself, as he smoothed back the hair from her forehead, what does anything matter but just this? Must I go now? He added aloud. She answered absently, it must be time to dress. Then she drew back a little, and laid her hands on his shoulders. Why love, oh, my dear love, she said. It came to him that they were the first words of endearment he had heard her speak, and their rareness gave them a magic quality of reassurance, as though no danger could strike through such a shield. A knock on the door made them draw apart. Anna lifted her hand to her hair and Darrow stooped to examine a photograph of Effie on the writing table. Come in, Anna said. The door opened and Sophie Viner entered. Seeing Darrow, she drew back. Do come in, Miss Viner, Anna repeated, looking at her kindly. The girl, a quick red in her cheeks, still hesitated on the threshold. I'm so sorry, but Effie has mislaid her Latin grammar, and I thought she might have left it here. I need it to prepare for tomorrow's lesson. Is this it? Darrow asked, picking up a book from the table. Oh, thank you. He held it out to her, and she took it and moved to the door. Wait a minute, please, Miss Viner, Anna said. And as the girl turned back, she went on with her quiet smile. Colin Effie told us you'd gone to your room with a headache. You mustn't sit up over tomorrow's lessons if you don't feel well. Sophie's blush deepened. You see, I have to. Latin's one of my weak points, and there's generally only one page of this book between me and Effie. She threw the words off with a half-ironic smile. Oh, excuse my disturbing you, she added. You didn't disturb me, Anna answered. Darrow perceived that she was looking intently at the girl, as though struck by something tense and tremulous in her face, her voice, her whole mien and attitude. You do look tired. You'd much better go straight to bed. Effie won't be sorry to skip her Latin. Thank you, but I'm really all right, murmured Sophie Viner. Her glance, making a swift circuit of the room, dwelt for an appreciable instant on the intimate propinquity of armchair and sofa corner, then she turned back to the door. Book 3, XVII, at dinner, that evening Madame de Chantel's slender monologue was thrown out over gulfs of silence. Owen was still in the same state of moody abstraction as when Darrow had left him at the piano, and even Anna's face, to her friend's vigilant eye, revealed not, perhaps, a personal preoccupation, but a vague sense of impending disturbance. She smiled, she bore a part in the talk, her eyes dwelt on Darrow's with their usual deep reliance, but beneath the surface of her serenity his tense perceptions detected a hidden stir. He was sufficiently self-possessed to tell himself that it was doubtless due to causes with which he was not directly concerned. He knew the question of Owen's marriage was soon to be raised, and the abrupt alteration in the young man's mood made it seem probable that he was himself the center of the atmospheric disturbance. For a moment it occurred to Darrow that Anna might have employed her afternoon in preparing Madame de Chantel for her grandson's impending announcement, but a glance at the elder lady's unclouded brow showed that he must seek elsewhere the clue to Owen's taciturnity and his stepmother's concern. Possibly Anna had found reason to change her own attitude in the matter, and had made the change known to Owen. But this, again, was negative by the fact that, during the afternoon's shooting, young Leith had been in a mood of almost extravagant expansiveness, and that, from the moment of his late return to the house till just before dinner, there had been, to Darrow's certain knowledge, no possibility of a private talk between himself and his stepmother. This obscured, if it narrowed, the field of conjecture, and Darrow's gropings threw him back on the conclusion that he was probably reading too much significance into the moods of a lad he hardly knew, and who had been described to him as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.